When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
This week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm Elise Glink. I'm here to help you make super smart decisions about your financial life. This week, because we're taping a little bit in advance, I'm going to be in California normally when we tape this, we're going to skip our Glinkonomics report. But you can always find more information at thinklink.com on the blog, or if you're not following me on Twitter, that's really where we push out a lot of really interesting information. All right? Let's move on to the rest of the show. The San Francisco Fed published a report last month on public policy, gentrification, and displacement. And my guest today has some really interesting insights into what they discovered. Daniel Hertz is a doctoral student at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. He writes on urban issues for a variety of publications, including cityobservatory.com, where he published an article on the Fed's report. You can find a link to that article in the show notes for this podcast. I'll tell you how to do that at the end of the podcast. And we'll hear his take on what we're learning about how public policy shapes gentrification and displacement trends in communities across the country. Next, I'm going to answer a listener question about whether to do renovations on a home in a rapidly changing neighborhood. When all the houses on your block are being renovated or torn down in order to make room for even larger homes, how do you decide what to do with your home and where best to spend your cash? I'm going to answer that question, offer my advice to this couple who don't have the means to carry out a major home improvement project and are wondering whether they should consider leaving the neighborhood rather than investing what little cash they have into a smaller remodeling project that won't actually enhance the resale value of their home. And believe it or not, I'm facing exactly the same quandary. So you can listen to me rant about that a little bit. And I'm going to end the show with a bit of a legal lesson. For anyone who owns property, it's worth acquainting yourself with what's called adverse possession. Adverse possession is when a property owner can be forced to forfeit his or her property without compensation to someone who has successfully occupied that property without challenge for a certain period of time. Squatter's rights are an example of adverse possession, but that's not the only instance in which it could affect you. So stay tuned for my tips on how to avoid ever dealing with that nightmare. Okay, that's the lineup for today's show, so let's get started. The Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco just published a literature review on gentrification, displacement, and the role of public investment. Today, I want to use that as an opportunity to talk about how our American cities and neighborhoods are changing and why that might be the case. To help me, my guest today is Daniel Hertz. He is a recent graduate of the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. He's written about urban demographics, neighborhood change, housing policy, and public transit for a variety of publications, including City Observatory, which uses data to analyze cities and the policies that shape them. Daniel, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. So why don't you start by giving me just kind of a high-level explanation of your article and sort of where you think we are with it.
Sure. So the Fed put together this sort of literature review of everything that we know, or everything that sort of the academic world has been able to show about gentrification and neighborhood change. And it starts with sort of big picture sweep of, you know, the last several decades. We know that, you know, for example, racial segregation peaked in about 1970 and has been very, very slowly declining since then, although still at very high levels in most places in the country. But at the same time, we know that income segregation has actually been getting much, much worse. And that's mostly driven by what we've been calling the secession of the rich. So poor people are somewhat more likely to live in majority poor neighborhoods, But rich people are about twice as likely to live in majority rich neighborhoods today compared to 1980.
So when you look at gentrification, and maybe you should give a definition of gentrification just for everybody who's watching this today, and maybe we can start from there.
Sure. So part of the issue is that there is no commonly agreed upon definition of gentrification, and that's one of the issues that the Fed report raises. But, you know, I think most broadly you could say that people think of gentrification as some sort of influx of either capital into a neighborhood in terms of, you know, new construction or rehabbing old buildings.
Right.
Or along with that, an influx of people into a neighborhood, people of some sort of higher socioeconomic status than the previous residents.
So property, there's displacement then of those people, because either you have people coming in, buying the buildings that they're renting in, and they're leaving, or they're recognizing a value-driven, you know, decision where somebody will pay them for their property. It's probably more money than they imagined they would ever get, and they take that and they leave. And so you have displacement of these people, and the neighborhood begins to turn over or change.
Well, so that's the big debate, right, is to what extent is neighborhood change in these situations about displacement, and how much there's a word called succession, which is something that, you know, demographers or sociologists use to just describe the sort of changing demographics of a neighborhood based on other factors. So the Fed report sort of chronicles this sort of raging debate in the literature. On one side are people like Lance Freeman, who's a academic at Columbia, who did studies in New York and across the country, and found that by his numbers, actually there's very little displacement, and most of and in fact that low-income people in New York in particular are less likely to move in neighborhoods that are gentrifying by his measure, and that the demographic change is really about changes in who moves in rather than increases in moves out. Now, other people would look at the data differently and say, no, in fact, there is displacement. And in fact, maybe part of the issue is that the people who are moving in are now skewing wealthier because housing prices are going up, and so lower income people can't afford to move in. You know, at City Observatory, we tend to think that, that something that this whole debate misses, though, is that, you know, the rule for low-income neighborhoods in America, even over the last 10, 15 years, has been stasis much more than change. We did a report called Stuck in Place a few months ago that found that, of neighborhoods that were high poverty in 1970, the overwhelming majority are still high poverty in 2010, and really only a small fraction of those gentrified. You know, so there are definitely places. I think even people like Lance Freeman would agree there definitely are some places where displacement is a real issue. You know, in places in New York and San Francisco, but overall the trend is again one more of stasis and sort of slow decline, rather than the sort of rapid change that makes the most headlines.
So when you looked at this, and you looked at sort of succession of neighborhoods and income segregation, where do you wind up? You know, for developers, most of the people who watch this program are real estate investors or they're homeowners or home buyers. You know, where does it... this idea of the changing, is there a changing migration pattern? I mean, it seems like it's super slow. I know that people think that neighborhoods change overnight, but it really isn't so fast. Is what you're saying is that it really isn't fast at all. Is that right?
Yeah, well, in some places it can seem very fast. And you're definitely right that there is a changing migration, right? We in another report we did called Young and Restless, we showed that, you know, there really has been a massive influx of particularly young people with college degrees moving into center cities in a way that was not true in previous generations.
But is that a bad thing?
No, I mean, we wouldn't say that it is. although, you know, it does, it can create pressures on housing prices, and you know, cities need to be aware of that, and they need to take steps to make sure that their neighborhoods remain or become increasingly, because you know, the status quo is really that they're not, that they become increasingly inclusive and diverse. And part of that is, you know, about affordable subsidized housing. Part of that is about allowing more construction of housing in places that are becoming in higher demand, so there isn't sort of a supply crunch, a shortage of cities, as we call it. So no, I mean, on the whole, we think it's quite a positive thing that people are you know, moving back to city centers, right? They're sort of reinvigorating public spaces. Another study that was mentioned in this Fed literature review mentioned that, in fact, in cities where you know, the wealthy people tend to live in the metropolitan core, those metropolitan areas are actually less segregated by income than the sort of standard setup, which is where the wealthy live on the sort of periphery, on the Indian of the far suburbs. So that is, you know, is also potentially a reason to hope that this trend is actually one that will create more equitable and more more integrated metropolitan areas. But it definitely needs to have a sort of a policy side to make sure that actually happens.
Right, and cities are broke. A lot of them, they have had a really tough 8 years, and affordable housing never seems to rise to the top level of interest. There's just always too many other things that are going on to keep that floating up, although some states, like in Illinois, there's been more of a move statewide, and I think if you'd see in some other places, not at all. So it's interesting, and it's good that you're watching. What exactly does cityobservatory.com, you know, what can we find on there in terms of resources?
Well, thank you for asking. Actually, so really quickly before that, I want to just say one place that has been having a really interesting debate about affordable housing is and integration is Seattle. Their city hall just put out a long list of housing recommendations, everything from new sort of real estate levies to pay for subsidized housing to dramatically expanding the places where you can build sort of multifamily, moderate to low cost housing, market rate stuff. And so for people who are interested in that, I think Seattle is really a place to look at. But so at cityobservatory.org, we have two main products. So on a sort of daily or mostly daily basis, we do what we call city commentaries, which are sort of you know, blogish articles, responding to something that's happened. So, for example, this Fed report, sort of summarizing and giving our take on that. And then also we do some sort of original data reporting. I'm working right now on a piece about bus operations costs going up and what that might mean for the future of public transit and public transit funding. And then we also have what we call city reports, which are these really richly researched, longer sort of think tank style reports that includes a couple I've mentioned today, including Young and Restless, Lost in Place, that really seek to answer a big question about what's going on in American cities. So, you know, are we becoming less or more segregated? You know, what's happened to poor neighborhoods? Or, you know, what is the truth about the migration of young people with high levels of human capital to central cities? Are they really moving there? So I think both of those are really valuable things, and I would encourage everybody who's watching to go check them out.
Well, I think that those things are really key, and whether young people are actually moving to center cities, whether they're really doing a sharing economy or not, whether they would rather walk and ride their bike than take public transportation, and whether public transportation is higher on their list than even driving a car, all of that stuff is changing. And the perception of it is changing how we think about building in cities and what that's going to mean over the next 100 years. I mean, cities are not temporary, right? You build and it lasts, and it's important to get it as right as you possibly can.
So, yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you so much for that. And Daniel, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate it. Is your neighborhood changing rapidly? Are your neighbors rehabbing, upgrading, or rebuilding their homes? How do you decide if home improvements are actually worth it in your changing neighborhood? So I got this question from a couple in a transitional neighborhood who are trying to decide on whether to invest in improving their house. Here's what they wrote. Many of our neighbors are doing major renovations or even tearing down their homes and rebuilding much larger, fancier houses. We're not in the financial position to do either right now and feel that anyone who might want to purchase our home someday would be looking more at the land value than at the actual house at this point. But we want to repaint, replace hardware, and make our house look better, but do it on a budget. Should we sell this house now and move to a neighborhood that's a little bit more stable, not as transitional, or should we just do what we want to the house and not worry about wasting our money? That's such a classic question, right? How do you improve? How much do you improve? And what's happening in a neighborhood and how should that affect that decision? Those are all the important questions to ask. You're in a tough situation because your neighborhood's housing stock has actually been being torn down house by house to make way for the next generation of homes. And as you have correctly surmised, if your house is destined to be torn down because the land value has outstripped the value of the home, no matter what you do to it, then any cash you spend in the home could be wasted. Still, that doesn't mean you can't decorate to your heart's content. It's just that whatever you spend most likely won't be reflected in the sales price of the home. If your heart will be broken knowing somebody's going to tear down what you've created, then you should sell the house now and find something else that'll improve in value because of what you're doing to it, rather than because of the size and location. On the other hand, I have to just say, on a personal note, I'm facing the same situation. I live in a really nice neighborhood, but around me over the 20 years that I've been living in this house, and we did a big renovation 16 years ago, but even so, the neighborhood has gotten super valuable, and homes all around that are as big as mine are being torn down to make way for uber mansions. And all of those homes are selling at a price that's twice what ours would be worth. And so my husband Sam and I have asked ourselves the same question. What do? Do we fix up the house? Do we sell it now? Do we move on? For us, we're going to continue to make some modest improvements. I'm going to build the patio I really want. We're going to be in this house another 5 to 10 years. But as I get closer to that 5 to 10 year mark, I can't say that we're going to be doing anything other than painting and making sure the thing doesn't fall down around us. We normally think of trespassing as an illegal invasion of someone else's private property. So how is it possible that trespassing can be the first step towards legally taking over someone's property without compensation? Adverse possession is a legal action by which a person can claim title to land that's owned by somebody else. Now, I know that sounds a little bit crazy, but it's a legal process that actually has roots dating all the way back to the Roman Empire, and it's meant to enable property that falls into disuse by an original owner to be appropriated by someone who has taken possession of it for an extended period of time, as long as it wasn't taken by theft or other illegal action. Laws vary by jurisdiction, and the general requirement for adverse possession to take place are as follows, right? So this could vary place by place. First, there must be what's known as a hostile occupation of the land, which is a legal way of saying that the trespasser must be established there. Now, in some cases, the trespasser must know that he or she is trespassing, but sometimes that knowledge is irrelevant. Second, the trespasser must actually possess the property. Living there and keeping up with the property is usually enough to show actual possession. Third, the possession must be open and notorious. In other words, it should be easy for the property owner to find out about the trespasser's presence. And fourth, the trespasser must show exclusive and continuous possession of the land for a designated period of time. Now, that amount of time varies by state from just a few years to well over 20 years. Now, once a trespasser has satisfied these standards, he or she can attempt to take adverse possession of a piece of property. It's important to remember that this doesn't just apply to a squatter coming in and taking over an empty house or lot. If your neighbor builds a fence on your property and you do nothing about it, you may be opening the door to an adverse possession claim on that portion of your property. So it's important to challenge any encroachments across your property line in a timely fashion. You might want to do it nicely, but you still want to challenge it. One last thought. If you're challenging an adverse possession claim, do not have your attorney send the trespasser a letter threatening legal action. That is only going to help the trespasser establish hostile occupation of your property. Instead, have your attorney write a letter thanking the trespasser for taking care of your property and revoking the privilege going forward. If done correctly, this might actually undermine the component of adversity necessary for an adverse possession claim to work. For more details, please see an attorney and find a real estate attorney who actually does this kind of work and has been successful in it. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. A big thank you to Daniel Hertz from City Observatory for being on the show. So if there was anything you missed, you never have to worry, because you can find the show notes to this episode at thinklink.com, thinklink.com. Please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes if you haven't yet already, and give us a rating or review while you're there. You can always find the show by searching for The Elise Kling Show in the podcast section of iTunes, and then all the rating stuff pops up. So you can do the same thing with my other podcast, Monday Morning Marketing with Elise Kling and John Byrne, for some extra marketing, PR, and social media advice. This is for anybody who owns a small or even large business. Believe it or not, I have another set of expertise, and that is talking to people about marketing, PR, and social media. That's what I do as part of my digital content agency, Think Glink Media. John Byrne is a former CMO for a global law firm, and he does the same thing, but in the legal arena. So every week we get together and just chat about it. All right, that's the end of another episode of The Elise Kling Show. I'm still your host, Elise Kling, and I'll be back next week with a new episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have an awesome week.